This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:17 p.m. on March 16th. Members present are Representative Carrick, Representative Freer, Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Co-Chair Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones. We are also being joined by Representative Coulombe, Representative Sadler, and Representative Nelson at 3:18 p.m. Welcome. We are asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she'll take care of it. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Renzo Moises from the Juno LAO for tech and teleconferencing support. We have two bills on the agenda today, both on their second hearing, when we'll be taking public testimony. The first bill up is HB 305 regarding Transportation Network Company driver pay, sponsored by Co-Chair Fields. The second bill is HB 350, Qualified Entity Income Tax, also sponsored by Co-Chair Fields. So let's begin with HB 305, Transportation Network Company driver pay. If Co-Chair Fields or his aide, Evan Anderson, would like to brief the committee on the substance of the bill before we head into public testimony. Hello, Mix Anderson. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you, Co-Chair Hall, Co-Chair Fields, members of the committee. For the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep. Fields. We heard this bill, House Bill 305, for the first time last week. It would simply set a standard of pay for Uber and Lyft drivers, rideshare drivers, at 90% of the published fare that the rider pays when they log into the app to request a ride. And then it also has a provision to pay drivers for some of their deadheading time, which is when they have to drive 10 miles or further outside of where they accepted the ride to pick up the driver. We heard from an invited testifier with SEIU Local 775 in Seattle last week, and today there's a few more invited testifiers we're hoping to hear from as well.
At ease. We are back on record. Before we pivot to public testimony, we have a couple of folks online who are part of invited testimony. And with that, we're going to start with Lena Simmet, senior researcher of poverty and inequality for the Human Rights Watch. Looks like they're online on Teams. Ms. Simmet, please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi everyone, Representative Fields and distinguished members of the committee. My name is Lena Simmet. I work as a senior advisor on economic justice with Human Rights Watch, an international non-governmental organization working in more than 100 countries, documenting human rights violations and making recommendations to address them. Our research on labor rights violations spans a wide range of issues, including forced labor, occupational safety and health, and labor protections in emerging sectors of the economy. To maintain our independence, Human Rights Watch does not accept funding from governments. I'm very glad that you're convening this hearing today on a consequential issue that, if effectively addressed, could have a major impact on the rights of platform workers in the state of Alaska and potentially across the country. For the past 6 years, we have been researching what is commonly referred to as the gig or platform economy from a human rights perspective. Last year, Human Rights Watch published The Gig Trap, a report examining algorithmic wage and labor exploitation in ride-hailing, food delivery, and grocery shopping platform services in the United States. Our research methodology included interviews with 95 platform workers across the country, as well as a survey of 127 workers in the state of Texas, which resulted in findings about 7 platform companies. While the survey was not representative, the patterns we identified are consistent with findings across academic research and labor groups, and they're directly relevant to the provisions under consideration in House Bill 305. Today, I would like to highlight 3 findings from our research that may be relevant to this committee's consideration of compensation standards for rideshare drivers. First, platform workers have very low and often unpredictable earnings with a significant share of unpaid work. Second, many workers lack access to social protection, meaning, for example, financial compensation in the event of work-related injury. And 3, algorithmic management systems create significant power imbalances between companies and workers. But before discussing these findings in more detail, it's important to understand what they look like in workers' everyday lives. Take Jacob F., a full-time platform worker Human Rights Watch interviewed in Dallas, Texas. Every morning he logs on knowing exactly how much he needs to earn that day, at least enough to cover rent, a bill, and groceries. Whether he reaches that number depends almost entirely on factors he cannot see or control. One day, a customer gave him a 4 out of 5 star rating, which is considered a low rating. But soon after, the app began sending him fewer orders. Wait times between jobs stretched longer, his weekly earnings dropped sharply, not because of anything he did differently, but because an algorithm had quietly reassessed him. The financial consequences were immediate. Jacob took on debt to buy groceries. He left the lights off in his apartment to cut his electric bill. He let other payments slide. He said, "Some days I know I need to make a certain amount to pay rent, but I don't make it. How do I go home and sleep?" That kind of precarity is not unusual. In our survey, a majority reported experiencing food insecurity in the previous year. Nearly 1 in 3 workers reported experiencing difficulty affording food and groceries nearly every month. Jacob's experience reflects the structural patterns our research documented across the platform economy, patterns that House Bill 305 could help address. Now to the 3 issues that I mentioned. The first concerns earnings. It is astonishingly difficult to know with certainty how much a platform worker earns by the hour. This opacity is not accidental. It is built into how the system operates. Platform workers are generally not paid hourly wages. Instead, they're paid by the gig for each ride they complete or each order they deliver. And platforms compensate workers almost exclusively for what they call engaged time, the period when a passenger is physically in the car or a delivery is in progress. But workers spend a substantial share of their working day waiting for requests, traveling to pick up locations, and repositioning themselves in search of customers. In our survey, workers reported spending roughly 40% of their working hours waiting or traveling to pickups, time that is unpaid, but without which the service cannot function. Drivers call this deadheading. It is not downtime. It is hidden, the hidden labor that makes every ride possible. In our Texas survey, workers reported gross hourly earnings of $16.75 per hour. That's including tips. But that figure does not reflect what workers actually take home. Because drivers are classified as independent contractors, they bear the full costs of operating their vehicles. After deducting expenses, such as car payments, fuel, commercial insurance, tolls, maintenance, and phone data plans, the average hourly wage dropped from $16.75 an hour to just $7.53 per hour. And there's more to deduct. Since most platform workers are classified as independent contractors, they are their own employers. This means they are also responsible to cover social security contributions mandated by state or federal law that employers typically share in employment relationships. Accounting for these non-wage benefits, calculated at standard rates in traditional transportation jobs, reduced the estimated hourly wage further to just $5.12 an hour. That average is 29% below the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour, and roughly 70% below what MIT considers to be a living wage in the state of Texas for a single adult at the time that we conducted the survey. Both figures are set higher in Alaska. The latest MIT estimate indicates that a single adult without children needs to earn at least $24.98 per hour to cover their everyday living expenses. Let's move to the second item, which concerns what happens when something goes wrong without access to social protection. Platform workers face significant occupational risks. Drivers and delivery workers spend long hours on the road, often under pressure to complete tasks quickly to maintain ratings or qualify for incentives. Many workers told Human Rights Watch that these pressures increase the risk of accidents. In our Texas survey, 1 in 3 workers reported having been involved in a work-related traffic accident, and 1 in 4 reported suffering a work-related injury. Because drivers are classified as independent contractors, companies do not contribute to unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, or employer-sponsored benefits. An injury, an account deactivation, or a sudden drop in demand can produce an immediate financial crisis with no protections to catch the fall. This exclusion denies them the essential securities that international standards call for. One worker we interviewed fractured her arm while making a grocery delivery. The injury kept her out of work for more than 2 months. The platform provided limited assistance, but not enough to cover her expenses. "I got majorly behind," she told us. The exclusion from social protection also carries a significant public cost. Our study estimated that the state of Texas lost more than $111 million in foregone unemployment insurance contributions between 2020 and 2022 due to the misclassification of workers. An audit by New Jersey's Department of Labor and Workforce Development found that Uber alone owed $523 million in taxes for unemployment and disability insurance from 2014 to 2018. Similar findings have emerged in California, Massachusetts, and Washington, suggesting that the fiscal impacts of worker misclassification may be widespread, including potentially in Alaska. The third issue concerns algorithmic management and power imbalance. Platform companies often present themselves as technology intermediaries that simply connect workers with customers. But the way they work is organized in reality often suggests otherwise. Opaque algorithms decide which worker receives which task, how much it pays, and how performance is evaluated. The system records how quickly workers accept requests, how long tasks take to complete, and how customers rate the service. Workers who decline too many jobs or accumulate low ratings may see fewer opportunities appear on their screens. Algorithmic management relies on pervasive monitoring of virtually every move that workers make. Yet many workers say they do not understand how decisions about their wages and performance are made or how to challenge them. This lack of transparency contributes to a working environment that incentivizes long, grueling hours for low and unpredictable pay, with detrimental effects on their rights to a decent living and safe and healthy working conditions. Under international labor standards, whether a worker is considered an employee does not depend on the label used in a contract. Instead, it depends on the reality of the working relationship, including whether a company directs or controls how the work is performed. By these measures, most platform companies function as employers. They determine pay rates, allocate and evaluate work, and can suspend or dismiss workers unilaterally. Yet by labeling workers as independent contractors, they deny these indicators of employment and evade their domestic labor obligations, such as fair pay, safe conditions, and social security contributions. This classification is not a technicality. It is what allows platforms to shift economic risks onto workers and, in many cases, onto the public. Taken together, low and unpredictable pay, unpaid working time, lack of social protection, and opaque algorithmic control, these features create a system that can leave workers trapped in a constant state of economic insecurity. It is within this broader context that House Bill 305 should be understood. The legislation before this committee is targeted and practical. While it does not resolve all structural problems in the platform economy, it does address two concrete and measurable sources of harm. First, it establishes that drivers must receive at least 90% of the fare charged to the rider. Currently, platforms have broad discretion over what share of the fare ultimately reaches the driver. Establishing a floor helps ensure that the riders pay more, drivers benefit rather than seeing additional revenue absorbed by the platform. Second, the bill requires compensation for deadhead mileage and time when drivers travel more than 10 miles to reach a rider. This recognizes that work begins before the passengers enter the vehicle. The committee may also wish to consider whether similar protections should extend to shorter trips, since unpaid travel time is a structural feature of this work at any distance, not only in longer runs. Human Rights Watch calls on policymakers to take additional steps to ensure that platform work respects workers' rights. These include transparency requirements around how algorithmic systems that determine pay and allocate work, meaningful due process for workers facing account deactivation, compensation for all working time, access to social protection, including unemployment insurance and workers' compensation, and protection of workers' ability to organize and bargain collectively. These questions are being addressed at the international level as well. In June 2025, governments, employers, and worker representatives at the International Labour Organization voted to begin negotiations on a new international labor standard on decent work in the platform economy. Those negotiations are ongoing, reflecting a growing global recognition that the platform economy requires clear rules to protect workers' rights. House Bill 305 represents a meaningful step forward. By increasing transparency around compensation and ensuring drivers receive a larger share of the fares they generate, it addresses some of the most immediate harms identified in our research and signals that Alaska expects platforms operating in the state to meet certain standards. As platform companies are reshaping our labor markets, ensuring that they respect workers' rights and provide fair compensation is ultimately a matter of policy choices. Those choices are now before this committee and the legislature of Alaska. I'm grateful for the committee's attention to this issue and welcome your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Simmet. And if you could, at your earliest convenience, email the committee your written testimony. It sounds like you were reading from a piece of paper or Word document. We would appreciate having that shared with the committee.
Absolutely.
Thank you. We have a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks, Ms. Simmet, for being here today. I was curious if you could help us understand what are some of the jurisdictions around the world that are doing the best job making sure that workers in these occupations can support themselves. I agree whether this is a living wage job is entirely a policy choice, and there have been many jobs through modern history where legislatures have made a policy choice that the job will be a living wage job. Construction springs to mind. We made that policy choice in America about 100 years ago. So what are some jurisdictions that are doing it well, and what are some of their models, if you don't mind sharing, including beyond the U.S. if appropriate? Thank you.
No, thank you for that question. I think it's important to learn from jurisdictions that have already made progress. Within the US, I think New York City is an interesting case, in part because of the large use of platform work in many different sectors, especially rideshare and food delivery. Due to a recent council study, there was a new minimum wage established, for instance, for food delivery workers in particular. That takes into account expenses that workers have and also the lack of other types of protections. I think the rate is going to be adjusted over time, but it is set significantly higher than the current city's minimum wage for other jobs and employment situations. So that is an interesting case to look at more closely. Internationally, I would recommend looking at the EU Platform Directive, which is sort of a broader initiative trying to regulate the platform economy in the EU, sort of touching on a range of issues that I also mentioned throughout my statement. And I also recommend looking at an ongoing pilot in Mexico, which mandates platform companies to hire workers as employees as soon as they earn more than the monthly minimum wage through platform companies. So looking more at full-time workers, ensuring that they have all the labor rights protections that traditionally come with employment, that they also receive that through platform work.
Follow up.
Through the chair, I think in America, a lot of the time we assume that if you pay workers decent wages, the service must cost more. And yet, I was surprised when visiting Paris and Barcelona this winter that both cab and rideshare drivers in Paris and Barcelona actually earn more than their counterparts in America, notwithstanding the high cost of living in those jurisdictions. And at least in Barcelona, earn a very high share of the fare. In Barcelona, Lyft drivers receive 85% of the fare. So I don't know if you have insight about how the economics work in these other jurisdictions, but to me they suggest that actually there's no inherent trade-off between what's good for a consumer and good for a working person, because in other parts of the world these drivers are earning a living wage, and yet they are not in America. So I don't know if you have any additional background on how the economics work in other jurisdictions, but if so, I think it could be helpful. Thank you.
No, it's a very good point. I can speak to the revenue or profit generated for companies in other jurisdictions, but on the one side, I think it's our strong stance that a service shouldn't be provided even at a very low cost if it comes to the expense of the worker. No, and if it means undercutting existing worker and labor rights protections. A point I wanted to make on cost is what we often see also in other markets is that often when platform companies enter new labor markets, they provide the service at a very low cost, lower cost than traditional companies provided the same service at. Until they reach near monopoly powers in that market. For instance, if you take taxi services, you would see platform companies come into the market, provide sort of share fares that are below traditional taxi costs, and then sort of take over the markets over time. And once that is reached, it sort of flips the script now, that all of a sudden the fares increase, and what workers receive is much lower. So this does go to the question of, what is the calculation behind these models? And what has been so difficult in researching this type of business model and labor market is the lack of transparency and also in terms of data that is being shared with the government. Now, so there's very little information about how much workers are making, how many workers companies are engaging at a certain time. Has that changed, right? Has that changed with the introduction of a certain regulation? it is very much operating in the dark. So I think part of the incentive also to regulate platform work is to gather more information to then take better informed policy decisions.
Okay, next question is coming from Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Thanks for your testimony. I'm just wondering if you know if other gig companies consider their workers to be independent contractors as well as transportation network companies, which is exclusively the subject of this bill. But just curious about the gig economy in general and how workers are classified.
In the companies that we studied, we looked at 7 companies in the United States. Workers are exclusively classified as independent contractors, which we believe goes to the heart of the issue. So by addressing the classification question, many of the issues that we documented could be resolved. And as you may know, there are ongoing legal debates in a few states in the U.S. That look at the issue of misclassification. The case of California and Proposition 22 is one of the sort of the most well-known cases, but these are ongoing debates. No? But in most companies, platform workers are classified, and we would say misclassified, as independent contractors.
Thank you, Ms. Simmet. Not seeing additional questions. Okay, one from Representative Sadler, and I put myself in the queue as well. Representative Sadler, please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Ms. Simmet, this is an effort that's going on, not in Alaska clearly, but in other states and nationally. Is the Human Rights Watch's desire to use passage of this bill in other states to pressure for a national law, or are you going to the Congress first and hoping to have a national standard that would be binding on states? What's your strategy here?
We believe that both are very much needed. No, I think ideally we would have a stronger federal bill that addresses the issue. And there have been some attempts. I think there's an ongoing Senate bill that looks at more transparency in platform work. But most of the progress that we have seen so far is really happening at the state level. So, and this is why we very much welcome this this initiative and this House bill, as we do see states recognizing the issue, seeing that more workers in their states are relying on this type of work for full-time and not just part-time work, and therefore trying to regulate it. And we hope that as more states come on board, that it would also lead to more federal engagement. But at this point, we very much try to move on both ends, the federal as well as the state and even local jurisdictions, not mentioning the case of New York City in particular.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
An associated question, thank you. Ms. Simmet, has your organization or your advocacy organization done any modeling or analysis of the effect on the industry of mandating a 90% cut of the fare to the driver?
We have not done any modeling on this particular proposal. So I wouldn't be able to speak to how that would impact workers' earnings. In general, what we call for is that workers should be paid at least a living wage. And there are living wage estimates that academic research institutions have provided that could be used. Or something that would be very welcome, of course, is also a deeper research into platform work in the state that could then determine what an appropriate living wage for platform work could be in the state of Alaska or in specific local jurisdictions. But yes.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Ms. Simmet, are there any other industries in America, maybe in Alaska, maybe in America, in which the government decides what is living wage and mandates that a company pay it?
Well, they do so through the minimum wage, in employment relationships. And in some states, minimum wages are more closely aligned to living wages, and in some states, they're very much out of touch. So So it could be done through minimum wages. But the case of New York that I mentioned has determined a specific wage threshold specifically for platform workers in food delivery. And that, I think that could be considered more of an attempt to pay specifically a living wage, to considering sort of factors in this type of job.
And Ms. Simmet, through the chair, well, not through the chair, but Ms. Simmet, do you know if Alaska has a minimum wage that would address this issue?
As far as I can tell, the state minimum wage, which, if I'm not mistaken, is currently $14 an hour, is lower than what MIT considers to be a living wage for a single adult in the state. So it would be, of course, welcome to be set higher. If it was, so looking at platform workers specifically, I think it really depends on sort of the broader context that workers are then classified as. If they were considered an employee, a range of protections come alongside that classification, right? So you then have access to Social Security, you have access to workers' compensation, etc. However, if misclassification continues, the wage rate needs to be set higher to accommodate for those protections that workers lack. So therefore, it would need to be set at a higher rate.
Yeah, we don't have a living wage law. We have a minimum wage law in Alaska, but thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Simmet. I have a couple questions. One is, how are tips handled? Are drivers, are they receiving the full tip, or is that also broken down and dispersed between, like, I suppose, the TNC and the driver?
There have been cases of sort of wage theft through tips not being delivered all the way to drivers. We have not documented that in our own research. We have mainly asked workers about sort of the share of tips and how much their earnings constitute of tips. Tips tend to be a significant share of workers' earnings, but it's very unreliable, right? Because the customer is not required to leave a tip. Plus, depending on the jurisdiction, customers sometimes tip before or after the ride. So the worker doesn't necessarily know if and how much they're getting tipped as they accept a ride. So which then makes it also difficult to know how much the worker is getting paid for a given gig.
Thank you. And a second question that I have is, if these wages in general are so low, why are the drivers even participating? How can they even afford to drive?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think there's a couple of things that are going on. On the one side, what we found is as workers enter platform work, their earnings tend to be better. There's a sign-on bonus. Some workers, for instance, reported there's a $600 sign-on bonus for if they complete a certain rides within the first 2 or 3 months, after which the bonus disappears and sometimes also the fares that people are offered declines. So in many cases of the workers that we surveyed and spoke with, it's sort of the same story. They start off, they make very good money, and then over time it becomes sort of a trickle and ends up in extremely low pay. But at that point, there's a lot of commitments they've made, right? Some of them upgraded their cars, because some platforms also have requirements of the types of car they use. And so they're locked into car payments, and essentially it sort of traps them into this type of work. I also want to consider that many people do this type of work because they do require flexibility. Many have care responsibilities at home that doesn't allow them to have sort of a traditional 9-to-5 type job. And so they end up doing platform work. Some do it as complementary income to other jobs that are also low paid. And in general, we see, and there's some excellent academic research that looked into who does platform work, right? And overwhelmingly, it is people who have a low income background. So there's also, which then raises the question, why do people generally engage in precarious and low paid work? No, there's often very little other opportunities provided to them that would give them higher paid and sort of better jobs.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Summit. Not seeing questions. Oh, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Simonet, from your testimony and from some of the information I'm looking and sponsoring the sponsors provided, it would appear that the desire of the bill and your organization is to make gig driving a full-time job. Is it your belief that driving for a transportation network company should be a full-time job? You've described some of the flexibility that supported people.
No, so that's not what we're calling for. We're calling to address misclassification. But even if people were classified as employees, it doesn't mean they have to do this full time, right? And it can remain a flexible job. There are W-2 contracts, which are sort of the traditional employee contracts, that also allow for much more flexible working hours and schedules, as long as a certain number of hours per month is completed. But we do believe, whether full-time or part-time, it should be a decent job, no? And it should pay, at the very least, the minimum wage that the states and the federal government have set. But our intention is not to turn this only into full-time work. That is not what we are calling for. However, I should say that from our research and other research, it seems that at least 30% of workers currently engaged in platform work already do this full-time. So it's a significant share of platform workers who don't only do this on the side. And maybe also one last comment on flexibility is, while workers engage in this type of work in the quest for flexible work arrangements, what we see in practice is that the work is not always particularly flexible, because the app sends workers sort of promotions and basically incentives to log on at a certain time of the day or certain days of the week that tend to have higher demand. So you can think about a Saturday evening for rideshare is particularly attractive in big cities. And this means that the workers essentially have to go on the road those times and those days in order to get a good enough number of requests. So the work is actually not as flexible as it is often made to appear. And in fact, workers really have to comply with sort of when is demand high, when do I get sent sort of promotions or requests by the app, and also in part because there's such long wait times between requests and pay is so low, many workers we spoke with are on the road for 10 to 12 hours, if not more, right? So that is not sort of a flexible work schedule at that point anymore.
Representative Sadler, we do need to be conscious of today's agenda.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Madam Chair, do we have more invited testifiers that we can ask questions about the transportation network company industry? I don't wish to belabor this witness with questions or this testifier. I do have questions about the business, but don't want to keep her up there longer than is comfortable.
Representative Sadler, there is one other invited testifier, and that is someone with IDG Benefits Fund. Mix Anderson, can you provide a little bit of background as far as maybe what that businesses?
Sure. Mr. Andrew Greenblatt, I think, can explain his background better than I can, but briefly, I believe he supports organizing efforts for drivers. So I think he can speak broadly to this industry as well.
Okay. Thank you. With that, not seeing additional questions from the committee, thank you very much. Representative Sadler, we do need to move on to the next invited testifier.
Then if the next testifier would define what uptake pricing is, because it's a term used extensively, I'd be appreciative.
Okay. Ms. Simmet, thank you very much for your time. We are going to turn now to Andrew Greenblatt, who is the founder and president of IDG Benefits Fund. Mr. Greenblatt, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. After that, we will consider committee questions.
Yes, hi. My name is Andrew Greenblatt. I'm actually the policy director for the Independent Drivers Guild. IDG Benefits Fund was something that was set up to provide benefits for drivers, but I've transitioned into a new role with the Independent Drivers Guild. So the Independent Drivers Guild is an organization that represents Uber and Lyft drivers on the East Coast and Midwest. We're creeping west. This is the furthest west I've ever testified, so thank you for that opportunity. And we represent about 300,000 drivers around the country. For the purposes of this testimony, it's important to know that we were the organization that filed the initial complaint with the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission that led to the system of pay that the previous testifier referred to as one of the best. We have been involved in shaping that ever since. I've done work in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Illinois in helping legislatures understand how this pay system works and doesn't work, and if you want to raise pay for drivers, how to do it the right way and how to do it the wrong way. And I thank Representative Fields today for inviting me to share some of that knowledge with this committee as you try to raise pay for workers. So I'll just jump into it. So I was fascinated to hear what the previous testifier was talking about, Ms. Simmet. When she talked about what the life is of drivers who live in unregulated areas, she's absolutely right. The work is terrible. It's precarious. Lots of legislatures have tried to raise pay. What we've seen is there's basically a right way and a wrong way to do this, and the wrong way seems to be the one that's done more often, but the right way does work really well. And so what I'm going to do today is break my comments into three parts. The first is I'm just going to really basically talk about how pay for these drivers works, so you can understand when you're turning the levers like HB 305 attempts to do, how are you really impacting pay? Then I'm going to give an example of what doesn't work and why, and then I'm going to go do a slightly deeper dive in on what is working and how it could be done even better in Alaska. I jump into questions at the end, right? That's how we'll do this. I'm going to try to use two different terms because it's really important to understand two different aspects to this. One I'm going to call trip pay. So that's how much money you get for your trip. So as the previous testifier pointed out, you only get paid for what they call engaged time. That's when you have a passenger in your car. And how much you get for that trip is your trip pay. Then I'm going to, on a separate note, I'm going to talk about wages. And wages is how much you get at the end of the day, at the end of the week, at the end of the month, like however you want to think about your wages. But those wages are what pays your rent, what pays your for food, et cetera, et cetera. So if you made, $1,000 a trip, but you only got one trip every 5 years, that's not enough money. But, I think what you care about as a driver is not your trip pay necessarily, it's your wages. It's how much money am I getting after I've worked a day, after I've worked a week? What am I taking home? To understand how wages arrive for drivers, it is a function of two different things. So it's a function first of how much you're going to get on each trip. What is your average trip pay? And then it is a function of how many trips you're going to get over that period. And so if you get enough trips, and again, Ms. Simmet had talked about the package delivery person, who when their trips went down, their pay went down, their wages went down. So even though they may have been making as much for each delivery, they got fewer deliveries, their wages declined, they couldn't pay their rent anymore. So anything that only addresses one of these two things, if you're only going to address trip pay, you're going to have trouble raising wages. And what drivers care about is their wages, not so much how much they get per trip. Okay, so understanding that those two things are the case, I want to talk very briefly about just the economics of work and pay. And I think all of us have had the experience that when you raise the pay for a job, it attracts more workers, right? If you run a McDonald's and you don't have enough people working the night shift, what's your solution to that problem? You raise pay. And when you raise pay, more people come out for the job. That's true of every job, everywhere. That's why jobs that take a ton of training, like being a doctor or a lawyer, pay more than jobs that take no training, because we need to attract people to go through all that training, so you raise pay, you earn more pay. Okay, so what happens in some of these systems that don't work is legislatures pass laws that raise trip pay. So how much is being offered to the drivers for each trip goes up. What that does is exactly what it does in every other industry. Oh, the trip pay went up, that attracts more drivers. And so now you have more drivers in the pool splitting the same number of trips, or in fact a somewhat smaller number of trips because the cost of the trips went up, and so you have a slightly lower number of customers. So what happens is you get more trip pay per trip, but fewer trips per week, and your wages stay about the same. And the ultimate example we saw of this was Seattle, where they raised the minimum pay per minute and per mile for each trip. So your trip pay went up. Every time you took, you know, trip from point A to point B, you used to get $10. Now you got $12. And what they did is study and found out that wages didn't really go up. And so they reacted to that by raising it again. And so now trip pay went up again. And so, not surprisingly, they did a study and they found out wages didn't go up. And now some of the most expensive trips in America are in Seattle, and yet the pay is really no higher than it was before they started, slightly higher, but not significantly higher than it was when they started this process. And the reason is drivers have fewer trips. They have more wait time between trips. And so the number that Ms. Simmet pointed out, that a typical driver, you know, will wait maybe 40% of their time for their next trip, it's significantly higher in Seattle. And so they're just waiting much longer for higher paying trips. So their wages remain the same. They're still not earning any more money at the end of the week. So the solution to this problem is you need to build into the system two things. One is you do need to raise trip pay. So HB 305 does offer some ways to do that. There's other ways to do that. The way we did it in New York City is the Taxi and Limousine Commission just sets a per minute and a per mile time amount you have to pay for each trip. So if the trip takes 10 minutes, you pay a certain amount for each minute. And if it's 5 miles, you pay a certain amount for each mile, and you add those together, and that's the trip pay for that trip. But then at the same time, what the New York City did was they built into the system some incentives for the companies to cap bringing on new drivers. Now, that wasn't our suggestion. I think that is it's not the best way to do that. The best way to do this is to have some licensing agency put a cap on how many workers are in the whole field, because both Uber and Lyft are sharing from the same pool, and you want to cap the size of the pool. But the way they did it in New York City was a little sloppier, and it led to a period of adjustment. And that period of adjustment was actually very difficult for drivers, where the companies would lock out the workers for periods of time, basically just turn off their apps. So when the Texas Limousine Commission was calculating, you know, how much did you make for wages, there were hours that drivers were just waiting for the apps to go back on, and they said, oh, there's no wages there. They weren't working there, their apps weren't on. So there was a period of adjustment, but it's finally shaken out, and it's working well in New York. With delivery workers, Ms. Simmet talked about the raise in pay. Delivery workers in New York, we're still seeing the lockouts for those workers in New York City, because, again, they didn't have one pool that caps how many workers there are, splitting the number of trips. And so in the end, what you need is, if you want workers to bring home more wages and you want to maintain a system where workers get to choose whenever they want to work, turn on their apps, turn off their apps, and so on, and you want to have customers have the ability to turn on this app whenever they want and know there's going to be workers there to pick them up and take them where they need to go, is you want a system that sets the minimum amount per minute and per mile, that puts a limit on how many drivers there are, but makes sure it's high enough to serve the needs of the public, and but is capped so that the higher pay doesn't keep attracting more workers. And when that happens, you get a system where workers are making the wages that you determine, whatever they are. Customers get the services they need. The companies can continue to operate, and it serves the function. If you only raise the pay per trip, if you only raise the per trip pay, you are not raising how much money workers take home. And so whatever bill you are considering, you have to look at it and say, are we only raising how much the driver makes per trip? Because if that's what we're doing, the drivers won't get any more money. They'll get more money on that trip, but they won't get any more money at the end of the week if they'll have fewer trips. And that's the thing you need to watch out for. I'd be happy to take questions. I wanted to kind of keep this short so that folks could ask me whatever they wanted to.
Thank you, Mr. Greenblatt. We are going to start off with Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks to the chair for being here and sharing your experience in different jurisdictions. I was curious, have states pursued the model that you're talking about where you both include a per trip pay metric as well as making sure that drivers have an adequate number of trips? And relatedly, would it be simpler, as Ms. Simmons said, to address this from a wages per hour worked perspective? Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So no state has implemented a system like New York yet. Massachusetts passed on the ballot a package of reforms for drivers that includes the right to form a union and negotiate pay using a system like the New York City system. So I expect Massachusetts to have a statewide system within about a year or less, and how long it takes to finalize the first round of regulations. That, by the way, that union will be certified in the state of Massachusetts sometime by the end of this month or middle of next month. So that's moving forward. We have similar legislation happening in California, so I expect a similar system to pop up there. Legislation is pending right now in Illinois that would also do the same thing. So New York is New York City is sort of the gold standard for this. It's the one place where this is really working. Again, I would make that one change there, and we can, if you want to really get into the weeds, I'd be happy to as to why that's important. But in general, the system is working with some fragility in New York City. In New York City, with a small change, I think it would be rock solid. Oh, your second question about per hour. So the problem with per hour wages is workers really want the flexibility. They are attracted to this work, and the question was asked them to the last testifier, why would you work for less than minimum wage? And we saw the same thing when we put the initial complaint into the Texas Limousine Commission. They ran a study and they found that New York City, like most of the country, workers were working for less than minimum wage when you take into account all of their expenses. And at the time in New York City, there were minimum wage jobs aplenty. Restaurants like McDonald's and so on were hiring. Why would you work for less than minimum wage when you could work for minimum wage? And the answer is flexibility. And the flexibility for lots of these workers is very particular. I have to pick up my kid after school at 2 in the afternoon and get them over to grandma's house, and then I get back to work at 2:30. And there's no shift that's going to let you take a half an hour like that off. And when the companies have to pay by the hour, they will schedule. So there's nothing in the law that would require them to, but every other industry, when you have to pay by the hour, schedules that has a customer-facing element to it, right? So there is piecework and things like that, but things that don't have a customer-facing element, you just get it done whenever you get it done and turn in your work. But for things where you have to be responsive to a customer, I want a burger right now, I want to be tripped from point A to point B right now, if you're going to pay by the hour, then you're going to schedule. You've got to make sure there's enough people, but not too many people at any given time. So scheduling will follow. Now, when we entered this, the drivers told us we don't want to be scheduled. And so the challenge that we were given as a driver worker organization was, okay, well, if we're not going to do by the hour, then how do we make sure that workers get minimum wage? And so the system that we designed for New York City achieves that on average. And it's not exactly the same, right? So the trade-off is you work when you want to, it's flexible. And if you say, well, I'm going to work at 2 in the morning on a Tuesday night out in the suburbs, you're not going to get any work. And so you're not going to make minimum wage that hour. But if you're going to work when it's raining during rush hour in the middle of the city, you're going to make a lot more than minimum wage. And so the way the system works, where you look at all of the trips, all of the hours that workers have their apps on, you calculate an average there, then you get an average minimum wage for the workers. Some will earn more some hours, some will earn less some hours. But overall, it beats what's going on now, where the drivers never make minimum wage and the companies are just pocketing the profit. So that's the system that we've designed. If you wanted to, you could say, look, we're just not going to have a flexible workforce in this way anymore, and we're going to make them pay by the hour, and then they will schedule, and then the workers will make minimum wage. So that's an option. It's not the one the drivers want. Interestingly, Prop 22, which did very little for workers. I mean, it was terrible. The companies kind of dressed it up as something that was wonderful. But really, the one thing it did was it guaranteed independent contractor status, and it passed among the drivers. The drivers supported it. We think that's a terrible answer to this question, right? Like, so offering drivers the, you know, something like this, the options for drivers shouldn't be, do you want to give up flexibility or do you want to not be able to make a decent wage? Those aren't the only two choices. What we've proven in New York City is we can design systems that match the way the workers want to work and still give them a minimum wage. We have a workers' comp system that works in New York. We have a benefits package that works in New York. We have found ways to let them work this way and still give them the rights every worker deserves. And so this is, you know, addressing pay is a good first step in Alaska. I hope it's just the beginning.
Representative Fields has a follow-up.
Well, through the chair, maybe you could elaborate on how some of those benefits work. And I really appreciate you testifying in the committee, taking time to listen to this, because a growing percentage of our workforce is going to be employed through an app. So I think we have to make a decision as a state. Do we want an ever-growing percentage of our workforce to be earning poverty wages? And I don't think we want that. And then we got to look at, well, what are these alternative models of ensuring that people can support themselves? So any elaboration on benefits would be appreciated. Thanks, Mr. Greenblatt.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. I'm proud to say I wrote the bill that led to benefits in New York State. The way it works is customers are charged a 0.5% surcharge on every trip, and that goes into a common fund that's administered by what began as a workers' compensation fund called the Black Car Fund, because back in the day before there was Uber and Lyft, they were called Black Cars, not Rideshare. And the Black Car Fund then administers a program that includes, let me step back for a second. So New York State has a very good system where workers can buy into a low-cost health insurance if they make too much to qualify for Medicaid. New York State has a next level that's very reasonably priced. And that's where most of our workers fall. They are out of poverty, but not rich. And so they get that, it's called the Essential Plan in New York. And so we then created a package of benefits that complement the Essential Plan and do a good job where the Essential Plan does a bad job. So those examples are free eyeglasses for everybody who needs them, a free dental plan, which includes $2,000 of free dental work every year, notably better than my dental plan, the free mental health counseling. It's an incredibly stressful job, as the previous testifier had mentioned. Free urgent care, because you can't make doctor's appointments and so on, you're hustling all the time. So if you twist your ankle and need to go to a doctor, you can do that for free using this benefit system, discounts on drugs and more. Oh, and free education, all kinds of professional development work that's included in this. And so all of that is paid for with 0.5% on every ride. Drivers qualify by doing a certain number of trips. So you can't just do one trip and get it, but it's not a high number. It's about one a week. If you average one trip a week, you qualify for these benefits. And then the benefits are all free. So everything I just laid out was free. You can upgrade your glasses and pay something, but generally you can get a free pair of glasses and other things. So the challenge of benefits in the gig economy is you're working for multiple employers at once, right? So while you're waiting for your next trip, you have your Uber and your Lyft app on. Or if you're doing delivery, you might have Grubhub and DoorDash and Uber Eats. And so which one of those is responsible for your benefits? And so the answer that we came up with is they all are responsible for putting into a common pool, and then the common pool covers the workers. And that's true for workers' comp, and it's full workers' comp. If you get hurt, you get your medical benefits paid for. If you're disabled, you get disability payments for the rest of your life, and so on. It's real workers' comp. And so all of that is covered. The workers' comp is an additional 2.5% on the trip. So overall, it's 2% on the trip. So overall, it's 2.5% on the trip. So all of that is covered in this common pool. So what we've done is we've taken the work the way the workers want to work, but we're trying to not give up rights. And so the rights are they want fair pay, they want worker protection like workers' comp, we want benefits, but we've designed them differently so the workers get all of those things in a different way. And it's working very well.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the explanation of how benefits work. We're before us on pay, not benefits, so I do have a question about the pay. I respect the concerns for drivers that a couple of our invited testifiers have been expressing, but capitalism works better when people on both sides of the transaction feel like they've won or beat the other person. Can you explain to me if or how this bill creates more value in the transportation network company system so that both labor on one side and capital on the other side can get the increase that they both would like to have? Or is this just a mandated redistribution of revenue from a particular business model?
It's minimum wage. So what it does is it sets a minimum standard. So if we as a society believe that there should be minimum wages, so in a purely capitalist system, kind of a neoliberal system that existed prior to minimum wage, the market determined wages, right? And so children were making a dollar a day working in coal mines, and that's where the market settled out. At some point, we as a society said that we want to set minimum standards, so no company should ever profit off of a child working for a dollar a day in a coal mine. That basic idea has bubbled up to we set minimum wages in general, where we say no company should be able to profit off the labor of somebody else unless they pay at least the minimum wage. So the struggle for this industry, which is completely supply and demand algorithmically driven, exactly like the old neoliberal pre-minimum wage world, is what happened was exactly what happened in the old days, is they find the surplus labor who are willing to work for minimum wage, and then they get them working and they pay the minimum wage, and it's a perfect supply and demand curve. The minimum wage law in Alaska that is already in place is a reaction against that, right? It says the minimum wage law in Alaska says we, the people of Alaska, know that some people would be willing to work for less than $14 an hour, and companies would gladly profit off of that. Right. But we as a society are going to set a minimum standard where nobody gets to profit off of somebody making less than $14 an hour. The companies found the loophole, which is to say, well, we're not going to call them employees, we're going to call them independent contractors, and now those loopholes need to be closed, or Alaska has to say, actually, we've changed our mind. It's okay now for some companies to pay whatever the market will bear, and let's go back to the old days. But it's not. I'm not making the argument that profits go up when you pay your workers more. I'm making the argument that society as a whole benefits when you set minimum standards for work.
Representative Sadler, is it directly related to the answer?
It is. Okay. Indeed. I make my question short and
follow up.
So this is not a minimum wage bill. This is a minimum share of revenue bill, frankly, as it's been explained, and you're making the case for a minimum wage. So I guess the question has to be asked, Mr. Greenblatt, would you be concerned that mandating 90% of the revenue from this business model goes towards drivers might tend to raise prices and reduce demand, and therefore reduce demand for the drivers and be ultimately not beneficial to the workers? Has that factor entered the calculations, your consideration?
My concerns with the bill is that it doesn't limit the drivers, the number of drivers. And so what happens is As you raise trip pay, and there are so many ways to raise trip pay. So in New York City, we did it by just mandating a per minute and per mile. This bill does it by mandating 90% plus deadhead fees when you return. All of those things are just different ways to raise the amount of money that goes that's paid to the driver per trip. I'm not terribly concerned with what mechanism you use to raise the trip pay. I'm concerned that raising the trip pay is half of what it takes to raise wages. Yeah. And if you don't have the other half, it doesn't work.
So you'd rather see us limit the number of drivers?
I'm sorry?
You'd rather see us limit the number of drivers as well, like a medallion system?
Yes.
Great, thank you. Any questions?
And by the way, Representative Sandler, if I may just say, like every employer does. So McDonald's does not say anyone can come work whenever they want to, and we're just going to punch in and we'll just pay all the time. Your legislature doesn't do that, right? You have a certain number of full-time employee budget lines, and people can't just walk in off the street and work and expect to get paid. No business, no government agency, nobody doesn't limit the number of workers. The problem with this industry is you can't count on the companies to limit the number of workers because they only pay you for trip time. And so the more workers who have the apps on, the better it is for the company because it lowers wait time for passengers. And so if you're willing to drive around waiting, you know, for the next trip, they're happy to have you do that because they're not paying you to do that. They're certainly benefiting from you doing that, right, because it lowers trip time for the passenger. So if the companies have created a new form of work where there is no detriment to having an unlimited number of workers, then somebody else has to step in and limit the number of workers like every other industry does. So we're not doing something radical here. We're just bringing this new form of work into line with traditional work.
Thank you, Mr. Greenblatt. Representative Coulomb.
Yes, hi. So just a clarification. What are you talking about that every other work the government limits the number of employees? I don't understand what you're saying there.
No. I'm every other form of work, there is a limit on the number of employees. And so part of how you make sure that workers get enough pay and the companies don't go out of business is they just say, look, you know, we have the night shift at McDonald's needs 10 workers. And so the employer limits that, and they do that in response to the hourly wages they have to pay. Because Uber and Lyft don't have to pay hourly wages, they don't limit the number of workers because they only pay for engaged time. So somebody is working for an hour but only getting paid for when someone's in the car. And so it's a screwed up system. So the government doesn't have to step in and tell McDonald's, hey, you have to limit the number of workers on the night shift to 10. They're going to do that naturally because what the government has told them is every worker on the night shift has to make at least $14 an hour. And so the owner is going to look at that situation and say, well, if I've got to pay $14 an hour, I don't want there to be 15 people. I only need 10. And so they limit the number of workers. So if 100 people apply for jobs, they're still only going to give 10 of them work. With Uber, if 100 people apply to be on the app tomorrow, they're going to take 100 of them. And if 1,000 apply, they're going to take 1,000 of them. There's no limit because they don't care. And so when 1,000 people log on, suddenly everybody's getting fewer trips and everybody's wages go down because the state of Alaska has not put a floor on that like they did for McDonald's. Uber goes, woohoo, shorter wait times. We don't care that the workers are only making $5 an hour or $8 an hour, whatever it is. We don't have to worry about the $14 an hour because of the way we classify our workers. And so somebody has to put the cap on or it doesn't work.
So in this case,
I believe it should be the government. By the way, in New York City, the way they did it in New York City was there is a penalty for the companies overall if they have too many workers, and that is that the minimum wage keeps going up, which causes a debt spiral. And so in New York City, what happens is the companies, just like McDonald's, say, look, we only need so many workers. It's about 60,000. We only need 60,000 drivers. And when they hit that number, they just don't onboard new workers, just like McDonald's. That is working in New York. It's not my preferred method, but if Alaska didn't want to get into the business of capping it, we could talk about and design a system like New York, which would force the companies to do their own capping, like you already do with McDonald's.
Follow up, Representative Coulomb.
So all these things that you're talking about, we've got a 2% surcharge, 0.5 surcharge. We've got to cover the cost of paying the drivers more, plus the companies have all the overhead. That's quite a big increase to the cost of the rides. And everybody knows when you raise the cost of the rides, people are not going to use it as much. And so the trips go down. So every example you were showing in New York and Seattle seems like every time the government made a move, it had a bad result, something that they didn't anticipate or didn't want. So then they had to make another rule to try to fix that result. So I'm having issues with having people from the outside try to regulate it to death. And what's going to happen is people aren't going to drive for Uber and people aren't going to even use Uber because it'll be so expensive. But, and I know your experience is on the East Coast, but this is Alaska. We don't have that many people here in the state. We certainly don't have, if we have a fraction of what New York City has for Uber drivers. And so my concern is, you know, maybe some New York City can absorb that kind of loss to drivers and to customers. But in Anchorage, if Uber start dropping off, or whoever, TNCs start saying it's we're not making enough, we don't have enough trips to even stay in Alaska, that's pretty impactful for our state. So I didn't know if you have much knowledge or experience with the Alaska market, if you could share, you know, your insights about that.
So I don't have experience in the Alaska market. I did want to respond to what you said about trips dropping. So trips actually went up in New York City. They were already going up. I think it's absolutely basic economics. If you raise the cost of something, use will go down. That's absolutely true. And there's no doubt that paying workers a minimum wage that's higher than their current wage will raise costs. Alaska has made that decision for all of the other workers in Alaska. So if McDonald's could pay $6 an hour, burgers would be cheaper. They would sell more burgers. And the fact is, Alaska has made the decision that says nobody should be asked to work for less than $14 an hour. So, and going back to the days of the coal mines, same thing. You know, we'd mine more coal if we could go back to paying kids $1 a day, right? So there's no doubt that this legislature has to make difficult decisions. There are trade-offs in public policy. And so the thing we're asking you to do is to say, look, you have a choice to make. You either are going to say it is okay for some Alaskans to earn less than the minimum wage as drivers, and we're going to be okay with that. Or you're going to set a minimum standard like you do for every other industry and say it's not okay for us to let any Alaskans earn less than minimum wage. And then if you're going to do that, then you have to design the system that works the best for everybody. And so I've offered you a way that works the best for everybody. If ultimately this legislature says we don't care about the drivers, and so it's fine that they're making less than the minimum wage, but not okay for everybody else, you can make that decision. But if you want to make the decision to raise the wages, I can tell you how to do it in the most effective way.
Okay, let's be clear. I'm not saying I don't care about drivers and I want children to work in the coal mine. What I'm saying that there's an economics to minimum wage and these kinds of decisions. So, yeah, now they make $14 an hour, but it increases the prices for everybody. So the worker really isn't getting that far ahead. It sounds like a living wage, but everybody's just cranking up the prices. They're still not able to get as much for their money. And so my concern is around economics. I'm not in here looking for slave labor or coal mining. You know, that's I guess I disagree in the context of what you put the question in.
Yeah, that's the choice you got to make as a legislator, right? I mean, right now your workers are making less than minimum wage. I would bet a lot of money on that. And so the question is, do you want to set a floor in which these workers are brought into the fold like all of your other workers? And if you do, there are ramifications. For every industry that has to pay minimum wage, there's ramifications. I agree with you. That's economics. But for me, I represent the human beings who do the work. And so I understand. And so for me, I'm concerned about the implications that the economics have for these workers and their families.
And just to reiterate, we do have a much smaller market. So there are some other concerns that, I mean, these guys could just pull out of Alaska. That's something I need to be aware of. It could be an unintended consequence.
They've threatened that in every state where they put in pay standards. They've done it in none. Minnesota is probably the best analogy in terms of size of the market. And they banged on the table and said, if you do this, we'll leave. And then they did it and they didn't leave. Companies like to make money. And they make money even if you have to pay minimum wage. And if they didn't, look, my view is if you can design a business that only works if you pay your workers less than minimum wage, then that's not a business, or it shouldn't be a business. It turns out that rideshare is a business that does make money even when the rideshare companies have to pay minimum wage. And every state that's set in any kind of standards, the companies stay because they still make money, just like McDonald's didn't close when you raised the minimum wage to $14. They want to make money.
Thank you, Mr. Greenblatt. The next question is coming from Co-Chair Fields.
Yeah, just looking forward again, I definitely appreciate the discussion, and I don't have any further questions for Mr. Greenblatt. I wanted to share with the committee members, I hope we can hear from the industry and their experience in different jurisdictions. Again, one of the interesting things to me is I have not observed a correlation between price and driver pay across different jurisdictions around the globe. And that is fascinating because that seems to defy what we assume about basic economics, and yet that's the reality that's out there. And if committee members have other people they want to hear from, I would welcome that because I think...
I'm sorry, can I respond to that?
Sure.
Study was done in Chicago when New York raised its pay after New York's minimum pay standards went in and pay went up, and Chicago didn't. The University of Chicago did a study. The price of rides went up faster in Chicago than they did in New York. How much the companies charge per trip is 100% based on the market. And so they already charge as much as the market will bear. It's just a question of, you know, how much do they have to share with other people. So in Chicago, they saw they could raise wages, they could raise rates. They did. They just didn't share it with the drivers.
Co-Chair Fields.
And I was just going to finish by saying, I think we're going to continue to see more and more jobs done through apps. And there will be more and more companies that say their employees are not employees, they're independent contractors. So I see this as... you know, the first case that we're dealing with, but there will be more. And my argument would be it's good to have middle class jobs where people can support themselves. And this is the first industry where we're grappling with it, but we're going to grapple with it in more industries. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields. I personally would really like to hear also from cab companies. I will say that my personal experience is when I am traveling back to district and I typically take a cab home from the airport to my house, and on average that costs me about $15. That's pretty regular. I had to take an Uber over the weekend making the exact same trip. There were no cabs available and I ended up spending $23. So not an insignificant difference when it comes to using an Uber versus using a cab. So I'm very interested in hearing not only from the transportation network company industry, but then also hearing from cab companies as well. Representative Sadler.
I won't ask a question, so I'll save time. There's been a couple comments about we don't want children working in coal mines. I have to take gentle exception to that. We stopped that practice a long time ago, and the co-chair wants to have good middle class jobs. If adults working in, young guy working in a coal mine does very well for himself up at Usabelli. So if we want to have old kids working in coal mines, that's a good job. Thanks.
Okay. Are there additional questions or comments from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your time, Mr. Greenblatt. With that, we will shift to public testimony. I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room who'd like to provide public testimony? Not seeing any, and I don't see anyone online to provide public testimony. I will close public testimony. With that, we are going to set this bill aside, and it will be heard at a later date. Clearly, the committee has additional questions.
Chair, can I make a comment?
Representative Colon.
I had just got a letter, I think it was today, from Uber that I think is really interesting. I hope the committee reads that. It's the other side of things.
Thank you, Representative Colon. Co-Chair Fields.
Yes, and I would like to hear from the companies about their different experience in different places as well.
Okay, With that, we are going to be setting this bill aside for a future hearing. And with that, we will transition to our second bill hearing, which is HB 350 regarding qualified entity income taxes. This is also sponsored by Co-Chair Fields. Mick Sanderson, would you please introduce yourself for the record and remind the committee what this bill proposes to do?
Sure. Thanks. For the record, Evan Anderson, Staff to Rep Fields. Thanks to Co-Chair Hall, Co-Chair Fields, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. We heard this bill, House Bill 350, for the first time last week. I think it was Monday. This bill proposes a tax on S-Corps or similar federal pass-through entities with a taxable income of greater than $25 million per year. And it sets that tax rate as the same as the existing C-Corp tax rate.
Thank you, Mick Sanderson. Are there questions from the committee? Co-Chair Fields.
I think the purpose, just for committee members, to bring this up was to see if committee members had questions at this time.
Representative Carrick, followed by Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the co-chair, to I think probably Ms. Anderson or potentially the bill sponsor directly, but could you provide just like a broad brush overview of other legislation that is currently working its way through the legislature, which may include these provisions, just to give a sense of where this bill falls within the landscape right now?
I could jump in on that.
Co-Chair Fields.
There is pending legislation that would establish a 9.4% tax on oil and gas companies, and I think that we are likely over the coming years to see companies in a range of industries that are incorporated as S-Corps and LLCs, and I actually would like to see more oil and gas companies that happen to be incorporated as S-Corps come here and be successful, and other companies too. And the goal is just to ensure that as our economy grows, we have some revenue to fund the public services that goes along with that economic growth and address what some people call the Alaska disconnect, which is that when we have more economic activity, actually we don't have revenue to fund the services for people who work in those industries. And addressing that disconnect is the purpose of this bill, and I do not want to target one industry with it.
Okay, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, with this bill, I don't know where to start, honestly. A 9.4% tax on pass-through entities. I guess I'll start. How do we start with 9.4%? What was the justification for picking that rate? Are you accepting the state's tax calculations just by reference? Help me understand what analysis led to this rate, or is it just an effort to increase revenue?
Co-chair
for schools or anything else?
Through the chair, the starting point was the existing C-Corp rate, and that is based on a desire to avoid what economists would call rent-seeking activity, which is where we encourage corporations to incorporate in one form or another to take advantage of a pre-existing tax structure. I think it's better to collect such revenue as necessary for a healthy society and have companies incorporated in a range of ways be successful. And that if we're going to have larger and larger S-Corps, which I think is going to happen in our state and around the country, then having a rational way to generate some revenue when they're successful is probably a good thing for the state and for the employees of those companies.
Follow-up, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Representative Fields. You said at our first hearing when the bill was introduced it was not intended to be targeted. And the time since we've introduced the bill, have you been able to do any research or analysis to show what other companies would be struck other than the larger example of Hillcorp, which is X-Corp? Who else?
Through the chair, I have talked with some stakeholders, and maybe my staff can reiterate to Department of Revenue, we would like them to come back to us with some more detailed information about who might be affected. Department of Revenue has said, well, we don't collect taxes from any of these companies yet, so we don't know. And I think they probably have the ability to do a little more research and provide us with a little more insight so that we might have better intelligence on that.
Right. And follow up to that specific
follow
point.
Follow up.
Even after revenue might give us their best estimation of who might be covered, going forward, assume if this were to become law, how would companies know where they stood on that threshold, whether they crossed the $25 million threshold or not? Would every company, every S Corp, need to file some kind of informational release or report or filing with the Department of Revenue so we'd find out if they would be struck covered by this tax or not? What information would they base it on?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we have been doing some research on other states, and some other state, you know, if you're looking at taxation, you can tax on the gross or the net, and there are states that have a very low gross tax that covers a wide range of businesses incorporated in this way. Texas actually does that, and some of those states do say that an S-Corp that does not have qualifying taxable income files something saying, we are this S-Corp or this LLC, and we do not have qualifying income, and therefore are not paying taxes this year. So that is one option.
So to probe that, so, Madam Chair,
Representative Sadler,
so you're saying that the S-Corps, we would rely on them to self-disclose and say, my company does or does not meet that threshold, and that would be sufficient? It, you know, just the personal attestation of the S-Corp?
Well, through the chair, Representative Sadler, I think other states, the you know, their departments of revenue or whatever they're called in those different states might choose to audit those reports. But yes, there are companies that have zero reportable tax earnings, and they do report that.
So just to be clear, Madam Chair, so we're saying that there would be audits of something. I guess other states do things, but what would Alaska do?
I think it would be great to hear from the Department of Revenue about how they might implement this, because I don't think all those questions have been answered.
Yeah. The question of how we would know which S corporations would need to file and what information would need to be filed on an annual basis would be good to know.
Great. We will ask them to come to the next committee meeting.
Okay. Additional questions from the committee? Representative Colom?
So a little bit off that. So is there any economic modeling after to on this bill and what how it would affect everything?
Through the chair, Representative Colom, economic modeling on.
So if you do some scenarios with we earn $10 million or $50 million revenue, this many businesses are impacted. What's the impact to investment? What's the impact to the prices on the supply chain, on everything? Just kind of the impact, because sometimes, and this I spoke to this about the other bill too, sometimes we have unintended consequences and we think it's a great idea and then we find out it was a mistake.
You know what, through the chair, that is a great idea, and I think for a subsequent hearing what we can do is we can try to run a regression analysis of states that have S-Corp and C-Corp taxes and see if there's any relationship and, say, economic growth in the last 10 years, because we can do an apples-to-apples comparison, at least across states' tax regimes. And, you know, there obviously are other differences across states, but that would be one way that we could attempt to answer that question.
Okay. Because I think, I mean, we always talk about the known S-Corps, but I'm wondering, you know, about, and it's not just S-Corps, it's LLC, it's everybody. So about Linden and Carlyle and Three Bears and like all these companies that we're just used to having around, I suspect that they're probably going to get roped into this. So what would that do to their investment in Alaska? So that's kind of why I wanted to see if there was any way to model that. Because they will reduce investment, but is it impactful enough? What's it look like? And what's the cost of goods for paying those taxes?
Yeah, through the chair, I share that interest. I have not heard from those companies that you mentioned that they would be taxed at the current threshold in the bill, but okay. I thought your other questions in committee the other day, do you just start at 9.4%? Is the rate 9.4%? Do you graduate? I mean, I think those are good questions, and obviously there's a threshold question of do members of the committee want to have any tax on S-Corps, and maybe some people don't, and that's fine. But for those who do, there might be, you know, a different structure than that is currently envisioned in the bill, and it might be structured around both wanting to collect revenue and encourage growth in a way where there's graduation versus simply starting at, say, 9.4%.
Well, and for both bills, I'm really worried about the affordability, living expenses here. Every time we tax, every time we make changes to companies, that falls on residents. It just does. It's the way it is. And so we're already having affordability problems, so I'm just really careful to do stuff like this because it rolls downhill.
Mix Anderson.
Yeah, for the record, Evan Anderson, staff to Rep Fields. If I can just offer a little bit more detail to Rep Colomb's question, but also kind of to Rep Carrick's earlier question. I believe SB 92, as it's currently drafted, does propose a graduated tax rate for smaller S corps and LLCs as well. So if it's helpful for the committee, I'd be happy to create a quick kind of comparative analysis so that we can take a look and see what they're envisioning for those smaller S corps as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Thank you for the ideas on further research we should do.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, the obvious question when I hear a proposal to put a 9.4% tax on S corporations is Hillcorp, which is likely, I can't prove it, but I suspect it's the largest revenue generating S corporation in Alaska. So we're proposing a 9.4 straight tax. It may be graduated after amendment, but it's 9.4. You know, the tax is an economic policy decision, and there are economic consequences, and we should have some idea of the effects. So do you think, to the sponsor, I guess, do you think Hillcorp, in response to this, will keep on chugging away the way it's going, or will it invest more money in Alaska? Will it invest less money in Alaska? What do you think the effects of this policy would be?
Co-chair,
through the chair, I'd be happy to invite Hillcorp to talk about that. I also have legislation on royalty modification, so you know, I think it's worth thinking about the relationship with other oil and gas statutes, and like Representative Colomb said, I think look at it in the context of we do need to collect sufficient revenue that people want to live here, and we want to have a pro-growth environment. So I think looking at it in the context of other tax policy makes sense.
Representative Sadler.
And having introduced a law to do this, have you thought of those consequences? Certainly it's something we should talk about, but have you thought about it? What do you think the effect's going to be?
Through the chair, absolutely. And I balance it against the number one thing I hear from constituents is their friends and colleagues who are professionals have left or have not moved here at all because of underfunded schools. So it is just that balance of right now we're losing economic opportunity because we have underfunded core services. So we do have to fund those services and have a pro-growth tax regime, and I think that's a balance. But, yes, I've absolutely thought about it.
Well, my question does stand. What do you suspect the effects will be of this bill?
Through the chair, because this bill has a very high threshold and because of the design of our corporate income tax, I think the effect would be zero in terms of investment decisions under a corporate tax structure, which would then apply to larger S-corps and LLCs, the companies would still have an incentive to invest and make profits. So I think if you did the economic analysis, they would actually make the same investment decisions. But I think it's a good idea to hear from them.
I appreciate the answer, sir.
Yeah.
Okay, not seeing additional questions from committee, we did notice public testimony, so I intend to open public testimony. Is there anybody in the room who would like to testify? Not seeing any, and not seeing anyone online to provide public testimony, I will close public testimony. Are there lasting questions, comments from the committee on HB 350?
Chair, I'm wondering, would you be willing to open public testimony if we do a major changes to the bill?
I'm very open to that, and it would appear that Co-Chair Fields is as well.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay. With that, that concludes our business in front of the committee today. Our next meeting is scheduled for Wednesday, March 18th at 3:15 p.m. With that, I will adjourn the committee at 4:51 p.m.